Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Rima Katz. Today, blockchain technology and cryptocurrency are setting a new standard in the B2B payments landscape. Stablecoins, in particular, are making big waves and are serving as the cornerstone for enterprise B2B crypto adoption. Today's guests, Eli Ayala, Chief Compliance Officer of Boost Payment Solutions, Daniel Artin, Vice President of Strategic Partnership of Boost Payment Solutions, and our own Steve Murphy, Director of Commercial Payments at Mercator Advisory Group, dive into how this technology is greatly improving workflows and creating significant cost efficiencies. They also discuss the U.S.'s current regulatory stance on blockchain, cryptocurrencies, and Web3, as well as the benefits these technologies can bring to businesses. To start, Daniel, can you set the stage for us around the role of blockchain technology in crypto and why it's so critical to B2B payments?
So we are at a seminal moment right now in the crypto ecosystem. For the first time, we're witnessing a shift from a speculative phase of the asset and to a utility phase. I will admit, prior to us preparing for this discussion, this was prior to the FTX scandal, which in and of itself is another seminal moment, but that's for a separate discussion. So for today's talk, we'll look deeper into the promises behind blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies, particularly stablecoins, and what role they'll play within the rapidly evolving world of B2B payments. So before we begin, I think it's important to define B2B payments as we view it from our vantage point in the industry. Oftentimes, it can be considered such a nebulous term. So in our world, we tend to focus primarily around enterprise payments tied to back office, procure-to-cash, invoice-related transactions between buyers and suppliers. This niche of payments in the market is littered with pain points, primarily due to costly fees, late payments, poor management of data, inaccurate data entries, and oftentimes lack of education in the marketplace around innovations that could occur to help solve a lot of these problems. So buyers and suppliers are used to delayed payments, frequent disputes amongst one another, and oftentimes there's sort of a status quo of distrust that results among commercial trading partners. So because B2B payments is such a vast space that has trillion-dollar addressable market domestically and globally, we believe this is a large run ramp for digitization. So if you think about it, a lot of the enterprises today, when it comes to embracing innovation, a lot of the digitization has touched different parts of the enterprise. So if you look at the cloud for data storage or payroll or benefits for wage disbursements and even communication, especially in the environment we live today, a lot of these areas of the enterprise have openly embraced innovation. Enterprise payments is on its way, but it's still a laggard in the space, largely because of the inertia that plagues the industry today. A lot of CFOs and treasurers looking to optimize payments have a large degree of being risk averse, and naturally so. You're taking systems and processes and workflows that have worked for the past 60, 70 years and now asking to migrate that to a new digital form, which you may not fully understand or know. So all that being said, there's a ton of room for innovation in this space. What we're going to talk about today is looking underneath these buzzwords of blockchain and cryptocurrency and unpacking what are the mechanics behind this technology? What are some real use cases that we deem, again, in our world of B2B payments? And what are some shortcomings that may or may not be addressed in the future? So really excited to start this discussion, and let's dive in.
Thanks very much for setting the stage, Daniel. I'd love to start off with the topic of regulation first. Eli, I'm curious, how is the United States' current regulatory stance on blockchain, cryptocurrencies, and Web3 affecting institutional players looking to enter the space?
All right, regulation, such a topic on people's minds, particularly in this realm. Let's start. United States, their approach or our approach to regulation of cryptocurrencies and other technologies in this space has been picking up speed, particularly given recent happenings, but it's still very much in development and exists primarily as a combination of both enforcement and draft legislation and frameworks. This majorly impacts institutional adoption. And to better understand why U.S. regulation is where it is today, we need to recognize the breadth of what crypto and blockchain technological innovation is doing to the existing financial infrastructure. Imagine putting some of the best soccer players on the pitch and telling them to play without first providing any rules. Messi, on one hand, may decide he can play out of bounds. Neymar may decide it's okay to use your hands. Even with some of the best players in the world, the beautiful game of soccer would not function safely and efficiently without clear rules, without those players abiding by those rules, and without the referees ensuring compliance with those rules. It appears as though the referees in the United States are down to two regulatory agencies seemingly competing to be that top regulator. Those include the Commodity and Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, and the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. The CFTC has opined that it is the more agile agency to be able to keep up with the evolving technology and innovation, and the SEC is solidifying their presence in a more direct way with regulation via enforcement. But things are changing constantly. We've seen the CFTC submit a subpoena via the chatbot function of the Ookie DAO, the first of its kind in terms of the serving of a decentralized autonomous organization. And we've seen with enforcement actions coming from both U.S. agencies, institutions that are looking and exploring blockchain and crypto solutions are more hesitant, but rightfully so. It's difficult, if not impossible, or at least implausible, to create lasting regulation for tech and potential new asset classes when policymakers have less historical knowledge and experience, as do the rest of us, and there are changes in the technology or changes in the specific usage of the technology occurring continuously daily. Plus, with crypto native giants, you know, the plug that Daniel made at the beginning is an example of this making their way into the news for bankruptcy filings. There's a lot of FUD or fear, uncertainty, and doubt driving decisions. Leaders of blockchain, cryptocurrency, and Web3 companies need to continue educating policymakers so that the United States can solidify frameworks and regulation that truly foster growth and innovation, but also, on the other hand, mitigate fraud and harm to end users. When that happens, I'm hoping that those institutional floodgates will open. But at the moment, we aren't quite there because of the current lack of an official playbook or so-called declared referees. It's created a landscape of companies guessing what is and what is not allowed. Certain players are abiding by one set of rules, while other players have a different set entirely. We need those clear rules and regulations to invite institutions onto the pitch. Otherwise, playing the game is fun for just a few winners that may skirt some of the rules. Hello, Web3 scams and the billions of dollars lost there, and there will be no real change to the U.S. financial infrastructure for the better without that. Though there is light at the end of the tunnel, changes are coming. We see it. We're hearing about it. People are talking about it. The population and policymakers are becoming more educated and exposed to this new age of financial technologies. And I really believe that the next 1 to 3 years will drive rapid regulatory change. You know, we're almost at a point where it has to for blockchain and crypto markets in the U.S. and abroad. And that will bring the clarity that institutions need to really start playing the game.
So, Ellie, this is Steve. I tend to agree with all of that. The White House executive order from 6 months ago, 7 months ago, has resulted in a lot of papers and positioning and framework, but not a lot of real stuff yet. I don't know if you saw, but the OCC announced yesterday also that they're establishing a fintech unit, which I thought was kind of an interesting announcement because I already thought they were evaluating that stuff, but they are setting up a special unit to evaluate fintechs, and that'll be in place in 2023. So that might have something to do with this as well. One of the things, I was at a recent conference, and we were discussing on a panel cryptocurrencies and blockchain. And one of the questions that came up was, you know, this whole crypto winter of which, you know, FTX is now part of, and whether or not that's having any impact overall. And the response from one of the panel experts was that you've got to separate the technology from the investment part of this. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely valid and true. You know, you obviously have the emergent technology and the different use cases that are being applied, payments, you know, you using for loans, for lending, all of that. These are specific use cases for blockchain technology. That's not all that it has to offer. And, you know, it is a good segue into what we're going to be talking about later in terms of the benefits of blockchain. But, you know, we're in a crypto winter. You hear people say, you know, really terrible things about this, but you also also hear a lot of crypto native experts and companies saying this is the time for building. And just what you said, you touched on it. It's time for building that emerging technology and, you know, still paying attention and getting out the pain points and the issues with the specific use cases. We're all continuing to learn. But yeah, I'm just excited to see what the tech continues to bring to us, and we'll get through these hurdles. I really believe it.
Got it. Thanks.
We've been hearing so much about blockchain and the opportunities that it presents. I'd love to hear some of the benefits of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I just shared, you know, the benefits of blockchain technology for institutions particularly is ever growing. You know, we're seeing it change constantly. Again, this is an emerging technology where utility that Daniel mentioned at the beginning is being explored. For institutions, we would like to specifically call out four factors that we believe are of critical importance when evaluating potentially introducing the blockchain technology to replace existing financial infrastructure. These four factors include transparency and traceability, consensus mechanisms, security and audit, and smart contracts. So let's dive into the first, transparency and traceability. All participants in the network or blockchain see the same data in a permissionless blockchain like Bitcoin and Ethereum. We've seen and we've heard of permission blockchains, which are a little bit separate here, but we're talking about permissionless blockchains. Again, the biggest ones, Bitcoin and Ethereum. And the data is also updated in real time. For example, think about all the steps involved in sourcing Mexican avocados to sell in New York City. From the farmers in Mexico to the bodega in NYC, there's much distance and potential for disruption of that supply chain. How are all the parties notified of any potential disruptions or changes in the product or the timing of delivery? Prior to utilizing blockchain technology, all data was centralized and separately managed by each party. There was no transparency, and the traceability of it was difficult given the need to contact each of those multiple different parties to understand the status of the product or the delivery, again, given that each party had their own set of data centralized on their own servers. With blockchain technology, one of the benefits is once that data is broadcast to the blockchain, all parties see the same information in that permissioned protocol. The data from the first leg of the avocado's journey to New York City can be seen by the final leg from the start, so it's very clear and apparent to all parties involved. If there's any question about where the avocados are located on their journey or any additional details about damages, delays, any of that sort, that is visible by all parties. I mean, imagine the potential of efficiencies to be gained by this. And there are institutions using this at the moment. So this is not a novel use case, but it's a growing use case. The second factor we'd like to get into is the concept of consensus mechanisms. Blockchains operate with consensus mechanisms. They are also known as consensus protocols or consensus algorithms, and they're used to verify transactions and maintain the security of the underlying blockchain or protocol. Those consensus mechanisms may differ from protocol to protocol, but a consistent element across the leading consensus mechanisms is the power to broadcast transactions with data or assets. That power is in the hands of many. This differs from traditional payments. For example, credit card payment authorization is provided by one party, the card issuer. The consensus mechanism of blockchain tech involving multiple unrelated parties prohibits or dramatically reduces the potential for monopolization and enhances security by reducing that concentration risk of having one party being the sole authorizing party. Third, we have security and audit. The extremely secure nature of blockchain makes it rather useful for both accounting and auditing because it significantly decreases the possibility of human error. You know, we see that in a lot of pain points of businesses and ensures the integrity of the records. On top of this, the ledger is immutable, meaning no participant can change or tamper with a transaction after it's been recorded to the shared ledger, not even the record owners. So once something is out there, it cannot be clawed back. It is for all parties to see. This right here is an auditor's dream. It's a compliance person's dream. You know, we love to see this, and also potentially a nightmare if you think about it could potentially take over some people's jobs functions. With that, I will pass it over to Daniel for the final critical factor that we're talking about for benefits of blockchain.
Awesome. Thanks, Ellie. So one of my favorite applications of blockchain is around smart contracts. I think this has huge potential within the B2B payments arena. For those who aren't familiar, smart contracts, these essentially are programmatic rules that are executed automatically and objectively on the blockchain once certain conditions are met. So what does this mean in layman's terms, or at least in B2B? Well, again, we live in a world where buyers and suppliers have established pre-negotiated commercial trading terms. I, buyer, once I approve this invoice, agree to pay you in 30 days. The truth of the matter is that aside from contract penalties or early pay discounts, sometimes even trade financing, there's not really a way to enforce these rules blindly by buyers and suppliers. Hence the disputes that we talked about a little bit earlier. You have third-party intermediaries that fulfill that gap today. Shameless plug, Dynamic Boost, our platform actually is a rules-based engine that enforces these kind of rules on the fly. But with smart contracts, these conditions and terms can actually be programmed and automatically fulfill those obligations across both parties on their behalf, automatically, which has never been seen before. So it's touchless, it's automatic, and most importantly, this instills a newfound level of trust among parties that otherwise was not there. So let's take a look at some real-world examples. It's interesting, I was reading an article recently around Walmart Canada and their deployment of blockchain. So a little bit of background, and I just found this super fascinating here. So Walmart Canada, they rely on over 2,500 carriers. Think of over-the-road trucks, 18-wheeler hauls. They're delivering about $12 billion worth of their goods each year. On any individual shipment, there's about 200 variables that's involved across the pickup and ultimate delivery of those goods. So think of things like fuel surcharges, shipment details, tariffs, etc. So if you do the math, that's over 7 billion invoice permutations per year for Walmart Canada. And probability says there's likely going to be some disruptions across that flow, which is going to result in some type of dispute, delayment of pickup of goods, people waiting, having goods on the dock, etc. So it was estimated that, you know, not just single to Walmart Canada, but the freight industry as a whole experiences close to 70% of their freight contracts result in some type of dispute. Which is just insane to me that we've accepted to live in that world as a status quo and navigate those inefficiencies. So obviously that ties up a significant amount of cost, and we're not talking about thousands or millions. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars each year tied to some of these woes. So in this particular instance, blockchain was deployed by Walmart Canada by a company called DLT Labs, who we happen to be very familiar with, really sleek technology. So what do? They basically took apart their supply chain and defined each of these variables and milestone events that have conditions tied to those instances. So once the truck driver reaches Minnesota, there should be an event that takes place because of that. All of that was mapped out on the blockchain, and it provided Walmart Canada and all of its suppliers and carriers with end-to-end tracking, visibility, and the results were just phenomenal. So because of this automation, invoices were created in real time. There was automatic proof of delivery. The payments were accelerated dramatically because there was real-time reconciliation involved. So all in all, Walmart Canada had realized over $30 million in cost savings through their deployment of this technology. And this is just fascinating to me. They were able to reduce their invoice disputes from 70% to below 2%. Let that sink in, 70% to below 2%. That's over a 97% increase in operational efficiencies. So, I mean, this to me just goes to show that this technology can truly bring about a new paradigm when it comes to efficiencies across business-to-business workflows and their related payments. So I just thought this was super, super interesting. Again, Walmart Canada is one of few that this can apply to, and freight and logistics is just one of few verticals that this can apply to as well. So,
but Daniel, our research on this goes back, you know, 5-6 years. And one of the earliest use cases that we identified for blockchain was certainly international and domestic trade. And so these are really good examples of, you know, it's really getting rolled out quickly. So listeners should understand that the trade, international trade, and use of smart contracts is really a bright use case. Just a quick question. I don't know which one of you would answer this, but for the benefit of listeners, In B2B use cases, would most of the networks being used in blockchain be permissioned or non-permissioned? And where does consensus come in a permissioned network?
I think that is a tough question to answer at the moment because, you know, we've got obviously the really big protocols being those permissionless, the Bitcoin, the Ethereum, but we also see some big players, particularly in the traditional finance space, building out their own permissioned blockchain. We also are seeing a lot of development in interoperability between chains, cross-chain tech just being rolled out, whether it's, you know, I heard about a cross-chain mixer the other day, which is not something that we necessarily want in the compliance realm. But I think the thing we need to take into consideration here is right now, a lot of the hacks or potentially nefarious activity that we're hearing about oftentimes involve this interoperability between protocols. So either we're at a point where we're saying, okay, hey, we're building these permissioned blockchains or even permissionless blockchains where we need to cross-chain for whatever reason, and we're going to keep building that interoperability. We're going to make it more secure so that that will be the future. Or it will be something where we decide, okay, this interoperability, the cross-chain activity, it's too insecure. We cannot figure out a way to give those end users the security they need when they're doing that cross-chain activity. So I don't have a specific answer right now, but those were things that came to mind when I thought of permission versus permissionless blockchains and the future of that.
I'll just add one comment on that. You know, if you're looking at this on a timeline, we're still very early stage. You know, we've got these promising use cases. So, you know, what you're starting to see is a lot of institutions dispersing their money evenly to see which horse ends up winning across both permission and permissionless. JP Morgan has been very vocal about building out their own permission blockchain, but you have Goldman Sachs also investing in Solana. You've got Ripple having a lot of institutional backers like Microsoft, etc. So I think a lot of folks are in the R&D phase and investing heavily in that without necessarily declaring one way or the other.
Okay, great. Thanks for clarifying.
You guys give a lot of great use cases for blockchain. Daniel, the one you gave about Walmart in terms of the percentage differences was really drastic. Do you have any that you can share in terms of cross-border use cases?
Yeah, this one is one of my favorite as well. I'm running out of favorites here. But, you know, I think before we dive into what are the promises of, and again, I think this is going to be a shift away necessarily from blockchain technology, but now coupling in cryptocurrencies, particularly stablecoins, I think it's important for viewers to understand what the problems are today. So let's talk about a recent study that was brought out by JP Morgan Chase. Just to give you the magnitude, it's estimated that global corporates are moving about $23.5 trillion across countries annually, cross-border payments. And a lot of that is tied to a legacy interbank network called SWIFT. Prior to recent events, a lot of people may or may not have even heard of SWIFT, but SWIFT is a Belgium-based cooperative that has established connections with various corresponding banks and financial members, and they facilitate transactions in more than 200 countries. It's estimated that SWIFT today processes $5 trillion of transactions per day, which is about 1.25 quadrillion transactions per year. The problem with SWIFT is, and this is just what's displayed and described in the industry, and it's no shade to SWIFT, but it's founded in 1974, and it's still used as the primary modality for these kind of payments. So it's old to a degree, it's inflexible, it's slow, and it can be quite costly for businesses to send money to their trading partners around the world. And what's fascinating about SWIFT is it's not actually holding or transferring the funds at all. It really allows a lot of these corresponding banks that they've stringed together to alert and communicate with one another once transactions are either incoming or being sent to the corresponding bank. So if you think about it, it really is a game of telephone. So what does that look like today? A lot of multinational businesses using this rail to make cross-border payments are subject to a lot of the common woes that come about in the game of telephone. This can be problematic. Each intermediary bank or corresponding bank along that chain, they could have different operating hours, they could have different exchange rates, messaging standards, different standards for KYC and compliance and pre-funding requirements. All of these are uncertainties that come across sending cross-border that could significantly delay the payments or make it so costly that it's not even worth the trouble. So in terms of cost, you know, we've seen transaction costs be normally around 5%, but it can range even up to 9%. which is substantial when you're talking about B2B enterprise. Those numbers can get very large very quickly. And it's also estimated that per year, you're looking at about $120 billion in cost for cross-border, which is, if you think about it, 50% of Portugal's GDP. It's an insane amount of money that's just being asked about these companies to fund cross-border transactions. So all that being said, there have been recent advancements in cross-border that have attempted to make this process more seamless, more faster and cheaper. Looking at companies like Transfermate, who we happen to be fans of, they've happened to build out their own global organic licensing network to help facilitate cross-border account transfers more smoothly. You have recent partnerships with JP Morgan Chase and Visa B2B Connect called Confirm to validate accounts more quickly on the blockchain, making those cross-border payments more secure and faster, and other advancements. So the truth of the matter is that despite these recent attempts, they are just that. We have yet to see a true scalable cross-border solution that can work seamlessly across countries, currency and payment systems, particularly that can handle a lot of the complexities involved with enterprise B2B payments. So let's talk a little bit about stable coins and what does that actually mean in this equation here. So we, through looking at the mechanics, and I'll caveat by saying it's yet to be determined whether or not this is sort of the promised child to solve this problem. But based off of the mechanics, stablecoins can serve as a blueprint, really, for this industry's fantasy of 24/7, 365, real-time, cross-border, cross-currency payment transactions. And first, let's define what stablecoins mean, because it's not a monolithic term. When you try to understand stablecoins, there are really three definitions. One is an asset-backed stablecoin. These are digital coins typically collateralized by real assets. Think of gold, silver, or other commodities or combination thereof. The second type is algorithmic. We heard a lot about these coins through the Terra Luna saga, which revealed that these digital coins aren't really backed by real assets. Instead, there's an algorithm that basically chains together two or more coins and sort of pegs their value to one another to maintain some sort of consistent value. Hugely problematic. Regulators are honing down on that as we speak. And the third one, which we're really focusing on, is fiat-backed stablecoins. So this means that for every digital coin, stablecoin that's minted, there's a dollar in reserve towards that coin. So it's completely price resilient. It's oftentimes pegged to a reserve currency. So if you look at USDC, which is one of the more popular ones issued by Circle or Binance USD, every single token that they have on the blockchain or available is backed, again, one-to-one by the US dollar. And there's attestations through various auditors to prove that. So we believe this third category of fiat-backed stablecoins, they have a lot of appeal to businesses. They're price resilient. They've been in the market. There's a first mover advantage there, and they could sort of be the on-ramp for enterprise cross-border B2B adoption. So we talked a little bit about the current state and a lot of the woes that exist with legacy networks like SWIFT. When you enter in stablecoins into that same arena, you now have fast, near instant settlement times. You have transactions that are near zero, and it's hugely cost efficient. You've got consistent messaging. So no longer this game of telephone, but you're looking at one blockchain and sort of one single source of truth among trading parties, real-time tracking, traceability, and it's also secure due to the immutable nature of the blockchain that Ellie spoke about earlier. So, you know, a lot of these things have been talked about before. It's nothing new, but when we think about these applications in our world of B2B, again, in enterprise payments, you could have very complex transactions that have costly, that account for multiple invoices. You've got a number of different factors. This isn't a perfect solution. I mean, let's talk about credit as one component. When you make a stablecoin transaction, those funds are immediately leaving your coffers and entering into the and sent to the supplier. In our world, there is an appeal and almost demand for working capital, both on the buyer and the supplier side. So businesses today in our world, they rely on credit as an instrument to help better manage cash flow and their balance sheet. It's yet to be determined how that's going to be incorporated into crypto and whether or not there's going to be institutions or intermediaries in place to actually serve as credit facilities for these type of engagements. The other is accounting. You know, we're working primarily with Fortune 1000, Fortune 500 businesses that have invested heavily into their current ERP and accounting systems. How does all this interact with their? How does the CFO treat stablecoins on the balance sheet? What kind of gap reporting is required for this type of transaction or this type of tool? Again, yet to be determined. And, you know, one of the more obvious ones, and it's often talked about when looking at some of the shortcomings of payment applications and blockchain, is that there's no reversals in a blockchain or crypto environment. So instances like that are often, and they happen. So remediation and how that's going to have to be alleviated will have to be dealt outside of the blockchain because of that fact. So how will buyers and suppliers handle reversals if they have a full-on adoption? And, you know, again, the ticket size for a lot of the B2B transactions tend to be large, so the downstream implications could be severe. And again, we're coming at this from an objective perspective. There's a ton of discussion going on around the speed, around the cost, but that's not it when it comes to B2B payments. So we'll wait and see how these companies will look to address this in a holistic manner. But until then, we're watching very closely.
So, Daniel, I won't get into specifics because we've covered a ton of ground here today, but suffice it to say that in my research, there is an amazing amount of activity going on in cross-border right now. So listeners will be seeing a lot more coming out over the next 6 months to 2 years.
Absolutely. For us, just some closing remarks here to the extent it helps close the loop here. We don't see businesses today screaming and demanding for particularly stable coins, but even blockchain, it's still early stage. That's our fair assessment on this technology. It's important to understand that this technology, again, has the promise, has the mechanics and the infrastructure to bring about a new paradigm when it comes to B2B payments. It can greatly improve workflows. The security that Ellie spoke about earlier is a huge component and can help alleviate a lot of compliance concerns, reduce the amount of paperwork that's involved. Companies of massive size still rely on paper checks, and it can create significant cost synergies, cost efficiencies across the B2B process. So we're early. A lot of things need to happen. But one thing that we do know holds true, and I know your audience will resonate with this, is that any advancements we see on the retail side, on the consumer side, which we think are sort of miles ahead when it comes to crypto and blockchain adoption, really begets institutional and B2B. So we're excited to see what's going to happen. We know it's on the horizon. We'll be watching closely.